Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 110, Interview with the Editor-in-Chief of Locus Magazine, Liza Gruen-Trombi. All right, let's get this party started.
Well, we finally made it happen, Sean.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
If you want to know how to be discovered in today's industry, then you need to talk with people who have actually been discovered in today's industry.
Doing this, we're going to be undercutting the noble calling of writer and generating instead pixel-stained techno-peasant wretches.
You should never start a creative endeavor that you're not a little bit worried might be impossible.
You can be an ongoing source of inspiration and a continuing challenge.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. I am your host, or co-host, Sean Farrell.
And this is Moses Sirigar.
And I'm Brent Bowen.
And today we are joined, as I said earlier, by the editor-in-chief of Locus Magazine. And Liza took over for Charles Brown after his passing in 2009. I had the very brief privilege of meeting him in 2008, I think it was, at the Writers of the Future workshop in 2008. And we didn't get to talk very long, but I was able to listen to him speak to the winners, and it was pretty cool. He did not have encouraging advice for them, but it was a good reality check, and I enjoyed it. And then I was able to talk with them a little bit the next day. Guys, did either one of you have a chance to meet Charles before he passed away?
I didn't. I can tell you, I have immense respect for anyone that runs a magazine or newspaper or anything like that for years and years and years. I started a little paper once when I was in college, and only managed to do it for about a year and a half at most, and it's a lot of work. So it's really something to appreciate about people who do that work.
I didn't either, and I have to tell you, I think after speaking with a lot of the people at World Fantasy, letting them know that I was going to be interviewing Liza and some of the things that we were going to be talking about, and even just speaking with Liza directly during the interview, you know, he's definitely someone that's sorely missed within the community. And I think that's the word he would like used, you know, when you hear the interview is, I think that was his aim, was to create conversation and create this form of community. And you see that, I think, with Locus. So I'm certainly sad that I didn't have the opportunity.
Yeah, I guess I should say Mr. Brown, too. And I was able to meet Liza, I think it was in 2007 at Writers of the Future as well, if I remember correctly. So it's been a while. But Brent, I think it was World Fantasy this last year, 2009, you did this interview. And I just want to say you did a really great job on this. In fact, I want to just publicly say that both you guys are doing just awesome jobs with your interviews. I felt like it took me like 30 or 35 shows before I wasn't making myself look like an idiot. And you guys are doing it right out of the box. You're doing a great job. So I just want to say thank you publicly on the show for the great work you're doing with interviews, guys. Really awesome.
Thanks. Hey, it's a lot of fun.
We've been listening to you for a while, so.
Oh, so you learned from me. That's what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh. Yeah, we learned it all from you.
Practiced in the car just listening to you every day to work.
Okay, and now I'm scared, stalker. We also have a little bit of feedback we'll get to later on, but before we get to the interview, news manager Moses, what do you have for us today?
LocusMag.com has a great feature now. They're, as the interview is going to show you, they're going more and more digital. They have digital issues available, and they have this great feature that makes my job so much easier. I want to thank Locus Mag for that, because it's called Latest Sci-Fi and Fantasy News right at the top of their website, and I plucked off some nice little stories from there to share with everyone tonight. For example, right up off the top here, Harlan Ellison to sell his first typewriter. He's selling his Remington Noiseless from the 30s with an asking price of $40,000, though that price is negotiable. It was on display at the Science Fiction Museum in Seattle from 2004 to 2010, and he talks about his motivations for selling the device. Quote, "It's all tied up in the fact that I'm 76 and I'm very ill, and like a sage old dog, I can smell when certain signs are there. We have to get some money, And as time goes by, you get more and more famous and less wealthy. Hmm. Love Harlan's honesty.
Wow.
Random House ebook sales up 250%. Global ebook sales at Random House are up 250% from the previous year, as announced by Chief Executive Marcus Dole.
Wait a minute. Did you say Random House sales are up 250%? Is that what you said?
Of their ebooks.
Okay. I was still thinking about Harlan. I'm like, wait a minute.
I've already moved on. And yeah, this is pretty neat. I mean, you know, from 2009 to 2010, ebook sales are up 250%. They say that Dole said that ebooks comprise nearly half of the overall first week sales in the U.S. this fall for some of their lead titles. So their lead titles, many of them getting about half ebook sales and half print sales. And they're expecting continued growth in 2011. So wow. your new overlords are here. They are ebooks.
Case in point of why Borders is restructuring again, yet again, and stores are closing. In fact, most the store where I wrote most of my first novel is one of the stores that's going to be closing. So it's really there's kind of a sense of nostalgia and kind of a sad note to some of the things that are happening with the chain retailers, you know.
That's funny you should say that, Brent, because my first short story, the first story I felt like was a real short story, and the first novel I started was all written longhand in a Borders cafe in San Diego.
They have the best leather chairs. That's all I can say. So
Barnes & Noble, you know, who knows I mean, they have their problems too, but they're also selling a lot of Nooks, and their Nook color was really popular for Christmas. I've recently seen that ebook sales have been really doing great at BarnesandNoble.com. I know a lot of indie writers who are selling quite a bit of ebooks there. So maybe their Nook thing will come in and save their day. And I think you can buy a Nook now, and then you go in the store and they offer you like coupons on coffee and stuff like that, and you can read any book that's in the store while you're in there. So they're really definitely trying to make an adaptation to this ebook reading world at Barnes & Noble. So hopefully that will be successful.
Yeah, that's what some of the analysts have said. I know looking at the Wall Street Journal that the analysts have said Barnes & Noble certainly been better at that than Borders. Borders was late to the game on the ebook, and you know, certainly Barnes & Noble with the Nook had a competitive device too. So
I'm still a paper book guy, though. I mean, I know I don't have any kind of digital reader. That's the part of the issue, obviously. But I have yet to experience ebook reading the way it is supposed to be experienced. So for me, it's still like I still don't get it.
You'll come around, but
when ebook readers are free, then I'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be under 100 the good ones by next Christmas, and I think $50 can't be too far off, you know. Yeah, let's see. Next story. This is actually a very serious note. Orson Scott Card suffered a mild stroke on New Year's Day 2011. According to his website, he is now back home, retraining his brain so that the fingers of his left hand strike the keys he is aiming for.
Mm.
Pretty intense. He will not be responding to most emails because his typing time is devoted to finishing his fiction. His site says that he will have, quote, a full recovery. His speech is unimpaired. He still plans to conduct radio and taped interviews, but is not planning any public appearances or travel for the foreseeable future, and he plans to spend the next several months writing at home. So we want to wish him a full recovery and many, many more days of writing to come.
And his new novel just came out. I got a copy of it in the mail a week or two ago. I'm trying to find it on the bookshelf, but it's too far away for me to see. But
is it The Lost Gate? The Lost Gate?
Yeah, that sounds right. I could go get it, but it would really mess up the recording. But then I saw it in the bookstore, too. So it was on the end cap at Borders, as long as Borders is around. But it looks like a good one. And I like his work. I've read, I probably read five or six of his novels. How about you guys? Have you read his stuff?
The Enders series. But
yeah, me too.
One of my favorites of his was The Folk of the Fringe. It's a short story collection. I don't think they printed a lot of them, but I really like that one a lot.
He's got a full-page ad. And Locus, once again, tying into Locus, introducing the first in a new fantasy series and a new boy hero with the power to unlock the fate of worlds, The Lost Gate. Dan North knew from childhood that his family was different. There's a secret library, for instance, with only a few dozen books that are written in a secret language, which Dan and his cousins are expected to learn, but they are never to speak a word of it with anyone else or even where anyone else might hear. Unfortunately, there are some secrets kept from Dan as well, secrets that will lead to disaster. Card's latest is an astounding urban fantasy about a clan of mages in exile in our world living in uneasy truce with other clans until Dan's birth brings the flames of open war back to life. So that's his new book. And the last news item I had here was Patrick Rothfuss, his fundraiser for Heifer International. He calls it World Builders, his thing that he uses to raise money for them every year. He does that, I think, in November, December every year. He's done three of them now. And I wrote him tonight just to make sure I got the numbers right. And I asked him how much money they've raised each year with that for that charity. So Heifer International, that's the very well-known group now that gives, you know, goats and bees and, you know, livestock and animals to people in third world countries and teaches them things about, you know, growing food and so forth. He says they raised $110,000 the first year. The next year they raised $195,000, about double the first year. And this year, it's gone up by about $100,000 every year, I guess. This year they raised about $290,000 for the fundraiser. He says that was despite being busy with editing his upcoming book, so it wasn't even that well organized, and they did quite well. So he's hoping for, you know, $400,000 next year, and that would put them up at about $1 million altogether. Wow. So yeah, that's a really cool thing. Book two in his series, The Wise Man's Fear, is coming out March 1st. That'll be a huge story in fantasy. Yeah, maybe we'll get him on the podcast. That would be cool.
Yeah, go get him, guys. No, that's great. My in-laws, every year for Christmas, they participate in that in my name as a gift. So it's kind of a cool thing they do. You know, we kind of they do one for each of us. So it's kind of like a family thing, you know.
That's very cool. Yeah, he does these you know, these really fun auctions too. Like this year, his agent, well, Pat auctions off that he will read your manuscript. His agent does, this year he did like 20,000 words he would read. That's Matt Bialer. And then Matt Bialer's assistant did the same thing. And then there was another editor, and I forget where that person was from, but, you know, they do these auctions on eBay for that. And I've participated in them every year, and I've come in second place in two of them the last 2 years. So it's one of those like eBay fail moments, but...
Someone sitting there with 5 seconds left. Click, click, click. Well, you know, going back to Harlan Ellison, that comment that he made that you said, Moses, about, you know, when you get older, what was the comment? You get older, there's less money. And
he says, I can smell when certain signs are there. We have to get some money. And as time goes by, you get more and more famous and less wealthy.
Yeah. Did you guys hear what, when I was talking about, this is several episodes back, I was talking about Before There Were Giants, an anthology that I received that had original or had a first published short stories from really famous writers and then interviews with them about writing. Did you guys hear me talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the comment that Spider Robinson made in there, he talked about something similar where, you know, the question was, what advice do you have for writers? And he said, don't quit your day job like I did because, you know, here I am basically at retirement age and I have no retirement. I published a book a year, but I have no retirement. I do have a paid off house, but basically no money. You know, he was very honest and very forthright about how difficult that is. And you could really sense it just reading it off the page. And that's certainly something for young writers like us to think about when we have these older folks who have accomplished so much saying, hey, you know, you need to keep a job because even if you do well, the money's not going to be there when you get older.
The writing industry has some infrastructure issues that, you know, some other industries and professions don't have. I mean, it's a creative pursuit, and that was one of the topics at Viable Paradise. When you would talk to the instructors, they would say, health insurance is a good thing, you know. If you're working a steady job that provides you benefits, take advantage of those benefits while you can, while you're pursuing your creative endeavors. And there was a whole session, a two-hour-long session on finances for writers, because it's not, you know, it's the very small percentage of the folks that are out there that are able to really sustain kind of rock star status, if you will. It's a very working person's profession.
Brent, one of the times we talked recently, I remember you had some kind of a quote or story from someone on the financial side of being a writer that I remember it was kind of a powerful statement, but I don't remember who it was.
Well, a couple things recently. I mean, it's funny. You start having these conversations, and then you pick up nuggets here and there. And I'll probably butcher the percentage. I'll have to look it up. But I don't want to lock up Skype looking it up to confirm it. But we were talking about Neil Gaiman, and recently I had heard or saw even maybe on Twitter he had a discussion about fewer than 6% of writers can actually do this feasibly full time. And that it was based on, finances. And then, I had an opportunity when I was talking with, I'll just leave it at that. I'll leave that. Was that the story, Moses, that you'd remembered?
Good enough.
Is that good enough?
Sounds like we're protecting the innocent here.
Well, I'm protecting. There's a certain protection of the Viable Paradise. Yeah. There was a story that was relayed to me while I was at Viable Paradise, so I won't mention any names.
Okay. This segment's going a little long, and we will be back with our interview, and then the three of us will be back after that. This episode is brought to you by The Purloined Boy, Book 1 of The Weirdling Cycle, written by Mortimus Clay. Gold medal winner of the 2010 Independent Publishers Book Award, The Purloined Boy is about a boy who was stolen by a boogeyman and taken to the city called Superbia. There, he is raised with other stolen children by the Guardians. The Guardians serve the interests of the boogeymen, but what are those interests? If you have an appetite for dystopian fantasy, conspiracies, and a talking mouse, visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com and click on our image for The Purloined Boy by Mortimus Clay. MortimusClay.com.
I'm at World Fantasy Convention, and I'm so pleased to have our next guest with us. I'm going to go ahead and proclaim her a genre dynamo, or as writer Ian Tregillis would say, a literary superhero. Since mid-2009, she's been Locus Magazine's editor-in-chief, all while raising two children. A hero, indeed. I'd like to welcome Liza Gruen-Trombi to the show. Welcome, Liza.
Yeah, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, your heroics extend beyond the day-to-day. I'm a father of two myself. Give our listeners a glimpse into what Liza's life is like over World Fantasy.
Well, you and I had a little conversation about scheduling this, and I was able to give you a little bit of a description of how many meetings and interviews and dinner plans that are not dinner with friends, but dinner with colleagues, and one must sparkle with wit and
wit and charm.
That's right. But it's pretty busy, Sometimes I'm really jealous of authors who come and they're like, well, I'm going to go see my agent, and I'm going to see a publisher, and then I'm going to see all my friends, and I'll do a panel. But then I'll go to the parties, and that's like the perfect convention. Like, I think that's the ideal thing. And I work a little bit more than that. This one's really bad because AussieCon was not many people got out there. And so I kind of went overboard and I sent emails to everybody. And like, we just counted them up, and there's 22. I've got 22 meetings and 4 interviews. And I'm doing an interview with you. I was meant to do a panel, and the programming came in too late, and I had meetings on my meetings. But
I remember you telling me when we were trying to even just get this interview scheduled, I think, that you were like, it was a blessing and a curse, because you had sent all these queries out to get people, get things lined up, and you were like, and you said, oh my goodness, they all said yes.
They did. Well, and I think everybody sort of felt the lack of a domestic convention when AussieCon was out. And I mean, I know there's NASFIC, but it's not quite, doesn't have that networking element to it necessarily. Sure. And everybody said yes. And people that I didn't know that don't normally come to World Fantasy came to World Fantasy. And I was trying to piece together hour-long slots, and then they were turning into 45-minute slots, and I have these little slim areas on my spreadsheet of schedule that are actual breaks. But it's good. I go home and I'm exhausted, but I'm happy, and you develop these relationships with people after a while that are fabulous.
Well, you were telling me even a great story, I think, before we got started, where you were relaying, as like, it was time to go to bed.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, I'll tell this. So, you know, I finished up all my meetings, and I went out to dinner with a couple authors and an agent, and then I came back to the mass signing, and I took photos and checked in with people there, and I went into the bar, and I saw a couple people and chatted briefly, and I was like, it's 11 o'clock. I'm going to be good. I'm going to go to bed. And I get up to the fifth floor where my room is, and I find out it's the party floor, and I can see everyone in the hallways. There are people in the hallway sitting around and drinking beers and bottles of water and chatting, and I walk down the hallway, and I thought, I'm going to have to just make sure I can actually sleep, and I did a little test run on the bed, and my eyes popped open, and I knew everyone was having fun and good conversations, and so I picked up my camera and put my shoes back on and went out, and it was good. Yeah, I took some photos and chatted with an author I hadn't seen in a little while and talked to Leslie Howell, who runs helps us with the Locus Awards, and it was really good. And, you know, I would have been sad in the morning if I had really not gone to any parties at all. So,
and none of us want to leave World Fantasy with regrets.
So that's right.
That was good. I think that's the motto. And it's funny, you walk around and everybody, when you see them in the morning, they're all like commiserating together. There's this community of commiseration where they're, I have my cup of coffee, and yes, I'm so glad I saw you last night. Can we all suffer together?
I know, those guys all get up at 10, and I had an 8:30 breakfast meeting. So that's the hard part.
Well, and I said, that's perhaps, I could proclaim you the busiest, you're probably one of the busiest folks here, so.
That's not running the convention. I might be right up there. I think the people who are running the con are probably going the whole time. I don't know that they get to turn their cell phones off and walk away from it. So,
well, for those of us who are subscribers, we're very thankful for all the efforts you put in. So thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
We work hard. We work hard.
Well, with all that, you've obviously, over the course of the last several days, you've been speaking to several authors and editors. But, you know, in those conversations, do they happen to be relaying any emerging trends, or even in your own opinion, do you seem to be seeing some themes that, you know, kind on the horizon that kind of piqued your interest over the last couple of days?
Actually, the things that I have heard about that I think are going to happen are not where I didn't hear here, but I heard at AussieCon.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I talked to a few authors of note, and they both mentioned, well, the two in particular mentioned upcoming novels they were considering that had robots in them. And then I talked to somebody else, and I'm not going to remember who it is now, and they said, oh, well, I was just writing something. And then one of my other friends, who's a author and who's been an author for a very long time, said, well, that can't be happening because I'm just about to write a story with nanotech and robots in it, and I never get it right. But I would be quite happy if robots were the next thing. I think that would be a nice sort of return to...
More of a kind of a retro...
Robots could be the next angels, which were the next zombies, which were the next vampires. Although maybe angels will go one way and robots will go the other, and that, you know, that would be fine, too. I don't mind it, but I actually was talking to somebody about it. There's, you know, when they first sort of imagined robots, and they were these humanoid things that would take care of your kids and bring you breakfast in the morning, and then
a very Jetsons variety.
Yes. But then they couldn't actually make the walking robot. Right, it was one of the hardest technological things. These are all those things you would hear about on sort of science snippet sort of news, is that the simple feat of walking is such a marvel of biology, and that they couldn't
replicate it. Yeah, the mechanics are so difficult.
And the balance and the way that it worked. Well, they just did it. They just made the walking robot. And I'm wondering if there's some thing that's going to come together there, that as technology actually happens, you know, we've been so scared of our future fiction, and so many people have, because just nobody knows what's going to happen next. And then, you know, maybe there's a little something there to back up our robot fiction. I wouldn't mind
seeing some of the real science maybe find its way into the fiction. That's it.
Well, you know, there's always that thing about, like, is it worth it to write? And I don't hold this opinion, but there's a lot of people like, why write fiction about science that could never happen? You know, and I think that when those things actually start to become more possible, then you can incorporate them into your fiction in a more comfortable way. Well, you know?
Sure, certainly. Yeah. People are at least a little less leery of doing that.
Right. Incorporating, you know, it's like the fascist and light argument, you know, but I think people should write what they want to write. I just think, you know, that when science starts to develop something, it can give fiction a little push in that direction. Too,
so. That's interesting. So from a science, and that doesn't surprise me, you've heard that element from OzzyCon, because, right, you know, you've got more of the science fiction element there. Anything else from a fantasy perspective that you've started to see?
Fantasy. You know, it's, honestly, no. And it doesn't mean that it's not out there, but what I've been hearing is sort of more of the same of what we've been seeing. I think people are sort of on the cusp of waiting for that next thing with fantasy. You know, I think ghost stories are strong, but I think they've always been strong. I think horror in general, if you consider that part of fantasy, is having an uptick. But it was coming from a trough of,
sure,
publish, you know, it had a big crash, and it, I think it's been slowly coming back. Straight fantasy, you know, epic fantasies always do well in limited numbers, you know, and clearly the supernatural has been going strong for a while. I don't know that I'm hearing, you know, other than the sort of current steampunk zeitgeist that crosses over fantasy and science fiction.
One of the things I've noticed and just happened upon happenstance in the last couple, in fact, because
okay,
of the...
Can I cut you off?
Yeah, sure.
Mermaids.
Mermaids.
That is the only thing that I have heard about recently that was a surprise.
Mermaids.
Several things. Mermaids.
Okay, everyone, watch out for...
But I don't know how interactive mermaids can be, since theoretically they're in the water, and I don't, you know, who knows if it'll last, but that's sort of the new...
You could have a deep water fantasy, I suppose, right?
I don't know, but that is the only thing that somebody mentioned to me that I hadn't heard about before.
Interesting. Well, it's one of the things I noticed, and it may be a trend that I might have been ignorant to, but one of the things I know, three of the authors that I'm speaking with over the last several days, they're all urban fantasy, which, or not all of them are urban fantasy, but a few of them are urban fantasies, but they're set in the middle of a conflict that we know.
Hmm.
So two of them are set in World War II. And then you have another, which is set in 70s Ireland with the IRA.
Those are like alternate history urban fantasies?
It's alternate history urban fantasies, which three of the authors, and I'm wondering if that's something,
yeah,
where people are taking regular... And then in the young adult, you have Scott Westerfeld, who took the,
right,
who took the World War One, the World War One element. So that's right, something I've kind of noticed. And didn't... Now, my reading list is certainly not as broad as your guys' is at the publication.
Well, in science fiction, I mean, Connie Willis's Blackout and All Clear is all set during the war. I mean, it's always been there, and maybe the insertion of urban fantasy into that will breathe a little bit of extra life into that, you know, type of writing. I don't know. I always think it's interesting. I think it's intimidating for authors, because you got to get it right.
Yeah, the degree of research required, yeah, and speaking to them about it, I mean, a lot of those folks is beta readers. A couple of them were telling me that they're even enlisting folks that don't, they may read casually.
Like history buffs.
They're history buffs.
Right.
Yeah, to make sure that they get it right.
Well, you know, you have to. You have to get that stuff right. If you're going to use real life, you got to get it right.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that if you're going to use your own made-up universe, you got to get that right, too. And you got to be consistent and, you know... You got to follow the rules, whether you made them up yourself or they're somebody else's, right?
Yeah.
It's when you don't follow the rules that people get, disappointed or lost, you know, and so.
Speaking of disappointed and lost, and trends that we might not want to talk about, Realms of Fantasy just folded. Is this, in your opinion, isolated incident? Are you expecting more of this from short fiction?
You know, it's a pity. I think right now, that leaves fantasy and science fiction as the only print fantasy market. Yeah, print's tough. Print's tough. There's a lot of elements to it that are... I mean, I'm not saying any of this stuff isn't tough. You know, everybody works hard. But print's hard. There's the distribution is always going to be the battle that everybody fights against. Mm-hmm. And I love magazines. I think they're great. I had, you know, subscriptions when I was a kid. I remember getting my first subscription, and like my dad got me Reader's Digest or something. He'd, but nothing to do with what I was interested in, but he got it for me. But I remember how excited I was when it would show up,
sure.
You know, and I would just read it cover to cover. And, you know, then later on getting an analog subscription, you know. Yeah. And I love that. I love the, it's like a little, I have probably 10 subscriptions to magazines right now that aren't, and like outside of science fiction, like just, you know, because I see Analog and Asimov's and Fantasy and Science Fiction, and I see Realms and I see Inner Zone, but just at, you know, outside of work, I have a bunch. I love magazines, but, you know, not everybody does. And I understand the desire for people to read digitally. I think it's great anywhere you can read, you know. It's all about the word. But I don't know. You know, I think that the people who are doing well now are incorporating digital
into their mix.
You know, yeah. I've heard really good things from Asimov's about what they're doing with their digital subscriptions, and I know other people are looking into it, and we're launching PDF and EPUB subscriptions in January. You know, we haven't done anything digitally other than the website. And the website is primarily content that's generated outside of the magazine with some, like we run 3 reviews and our spotlights a month. And we run...
Well, you guys do, I think, you guys are almost like Tor.com in a way, where Tor made that conscious decision.
Right.
Where they said, you know what, we're going to be a hub for the genre. Genre. You guys, I've started to notice where you've really started to become an embraced. I mean, our podcast, for instance, is listed pretty generally as, you know, one as a source for information about speculative fiction, where you become kind of a hub for a hub for genre.
Well, you know, in some ways, that's the most valuable part of the website. You know, Mark Kelly does a great job, and he lists all those blinks, which are just links to things that are happening. Somebody reviewed something in the on Salon, or somebody is having a discussion on their blog, or, you know, Ansible is up, or, and he lists everything that happens, and that's fabulous. And we list the news, and we run bestsellers and new books. And it was never really intended for the site itself to be the same content as the magazine. We've started to put more content online. I know it always confuses people. There's people who go to the website and they're like, there's a magazine?
I've been here, yeah.
Right? Because there is so much content in the website. You know, Mark Kelly does the awards indexing, which is hugely valuable to people. And we have forthcoming books lists. We have our index to... well, for me, I use our index to reviews and interviews constantly, because that tells me what's, you know, where to go forward, what we've done before.
And it, as someone who interviews authors, I use it as well. It's a nice resource. I pulled an interview, I think, from almost 10 years ago when I spoke with Nancy Kress a couple months ago.
And it has these really interesting, you know, little time capsule moments when, you know, we'll have the bio, which is nice and informative and gives you that sort of institutional information that you want. But then you also get this glimpse of somebody in this moment in their career. You know, people like Neil Gaiman, we have 4 or 5 interviews of, honestly, you know. And, so interesting to like see what he was talking about at different times, or you know, people who have more tumultuous careers. You know, it's really interesting. You see somebody saying, you know, well, I don't really know what I'm going to do next, and then next thing you know, they've written their opus. You know, and, it's interesting. We actually had a little while where we were thinking about trying to publish a book of selected interviews of people sort of over their careers. With pictures of them, from sort of a biographical interview in a way, because you would have these different moments in time. But
would you consider almost soliciting reflections too?
Absolutely. Or we could have people do, right, an introduction or a sort of epilogue to their own interview.
To their own interview. I think that'd be interesting. Because I'm sure that would be very introspective for them as well, as to give them those points of reflection.
Because
some of us don't honestly stop to look back, you know?
It's true. If we could keep them from wanting to edit them.
No, you can't. Sorry, kids. This is fixed in... This is fixed in time.
But anyway, to get back to realms...
Yeah.
The original question. I hope not. I hope it's not a trend. You know, I think magazines have been shutting down for a long time, and people have been making new magazines. I don't know how many more print magazines will be revived. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, there's always the sort of... We're going to bring back Astounding, or we're going to, you know, do these things. Because there are so many limitations in print. It's unwieldy in comparison to digital information, but it's a lot harder to show people in a very physical sense, you know.
Sure.
In the signing, there were two authors who had their iPads up that were running displays of their ebooks. I thought that was very cool, you know, but... It would take a lot of iPads to get that image out there.
It would. Well, and there's a British.
Maybe we'll bring back a pasteboard flyers or something for
to promote the, yeah to be
promote
able to
promote books you
to
know
be able to promote those. Yeah, that's interesting. How would you be able to market other than your current issue and your current book? Yeah, there's a British magazine. I think it's Spectra that has just recently launched an issue or two, and it's exclusively ebook. They've got iPad. They just have about every ebook version, which I thought was very fascinating how they decided to build their distribution model.
Right.
Because it's not, I mean, they have a website, of course, where it's kind of a community. They've started a community, but their model really for the works themselves are really ebook. So, interesting to see how that's changed.
Well, and ebook has some functionality. Some good functionality for text, but it's HTML, you know, and it has the limitations of a website, essentially, which means for us, columns are hard, images are hard, there's a lot of coding that sort of goes into doing that, but we're going to get there.
So you were talking about some of your Locus's plans for getting more into electronic publishing. Can you outline those a little bit more? You'd mentioned, what was it, January, I think?
January is our 600th issue of Locus, I know. At least number 600, though somebody will dispute me, I'm sure, because apparently there was a 1 and a 1A at some point. Or something like that. Or a trial run, a 0.5.
Ooh, the liner notes, even in Locus. Good history, liner notes.
But issue number 600 is coming up. I think it's my number 95, and I don't know that many, but in comparison. But issue number 600, and it's... I haven't entirely figured out. I've got another month and a half to figure out what we'll do. I haven't entirely figured out what we'll do, but we're definitely launching PDF versions of the magazine.
Okay.
You know, I really wanted to do it in late 2008, but I was pregnant.
Okay.
And then in May, I had the baby, and in July, Charles died.
Okay.
And the rest of 2009, I don't remember very well, because I was so busy that...
Learning and running the course of normal business
doing,
with Charles.
Doing
passing,
all of these things, and trying to cope with so much stuff in the estate and everything. It was crazy. And now, 2010, things have settled down. We've sort of gotten through a full cycle of issues since Charles died, and I'm ready to move forward. And so PDF subscriptions, probably hosted on our site, at least initially. I'd, of course, love to distribute via anything I could find, but I'm hearing that it's tricky.
Mm-hmm.
The digital distribution, there's Apple, and there's Amazon, and there's... FictionWise doesn't do subs now because of Pubit, I think, or is it ePubit?
It's ePub. I think it's I'm not as familiar with FictionWise.
Barnes & Noble owns FictionWise, and it just launched Pubit, which is their magazine platform, or the magazines are hosted there. But you have to negotiate with all those people. I haven't approached anybody yet about it. But on our site, we already host our own subscription. We already have our own subscribing page, and so it'll be on there, and we'll host for download. And my plan is to have EPUB and Kindle in place also, but I'm not guaranteeing it because we're not there yet.
Okay.
So when I have several issues worth of EPUB and Kindle versions of previous issues done by production, then I'll feel like we're ready to move forward. I want Locus out there. I want people to look at it and read it. I want people to tell their friends that are readers who haven't heard of Locus or who aren't in the community about Locus. And, you know, it's hard to do that no matter what format you're in. So the more the merrier.
Yeah, the more. And you want to get it in the hands of the readers, whatever device they're using. Now, from a business model standpoint, you guys kind of work that arrangement out. So, you know, for instance, I'm already a regular subscriber to the print magazine.
Right.
So in that instance, is that going to be an add-on kind of service? Or is that one of those things where...
I haven't totally hammered out all the details. However, I think that... And honestly, the physical printing costs us about $1.25 an issue.
Okay.
And the shipping costs on average, because we have a couple different ways, probably 70, 75 cents.
Okay. Yeah. So
if I pull that out, I know people have that expectation that digital is cheaper.
Yeah, sure.
In grand ways, that it's not actually. You know, we send our issue out to the printer, and a week later we get it back. You know, and that costs us this chunk of money.
Yeah.
But we spend all month building it.
Yeah.
And I have 6 people working full time, and I have offsite reviewers, and I have a cover designer, and I spend a lot of money making the content, you know. And I know that everybody's heard this from publishers, that, you know, you can't devalue the text, because this is what we're all working towards, is, you know, getting the value out of our work, you know, whether you're an author, an editor, or whatever you are. And so it'll probably price out about, and I should add on, as a note, I should add on something, because we have to relay out the magazine for EPUB.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I talked to Ann Sowards, you know, who's an editor with Penguin, right. And we talked about how all of this has changed her job as an editor, and she said, you know, it's not taking anything off the table for us, and I think that's what people forget.
It adds more work, because you're doing two different, you know, formats of the same thing, but you have to do different work for each one. Yeah.
Yeah, and we just acknowledge that there's going to even be within the, you know, the book space, that essentially there's multiple versions of that, which folks then forget is you've got developer time associated with that on top of the regular activity.
Like,
so
we've had to spend a very relatively long time, because we don't have a lot of free time around the office, as you might imagine, a long time figuring it out, you know. And fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, it's being driven, the EPUB technology is being driven by publishers. Mm-hmm. And it's actually HTML, and web designers should be driving it. But it's good that web publishers are driving it, because it would be nice if there was a place in the middle where everybody was working together.
Sure, it's forcing some coordination, a little conflict.
Right.
Yeah,
but
a little friction.
But the good thing about it is InDesign is the program of choice right now for EPUB, and that's what we lay out the magazine in.
Excellent.
So... Now, this doesn't mean that we go to our InDesign file and we hit, you know, create EPUB and it happens. It means that we spend 8 or 10 hours relaying out the entire magazine. And then we hit, and then we go in and we replace all the messy code that it puts in, and we do it. But it's exciting. But so it'll be a little cheaper. We're going to take off what we can take off, but we're not going to kill ourselves, because part of this is survival, you know.
Yeah.
I think that... And I'm probably going to regret saying this now, because I haven't totally made the decision. But I think that it'll be a relatively cheap add-on for domestic subscriptions.
Okay.
I haven't figured out what the price is. I'm a little nervous about saying it'll be $5 extra.
Yeah.
Because I don't want someone to think a year's worth of it is only $5. I don't want to create that.
You don't want to create that expectation.
Yeah. But at the same time... Because I think it'll be an add-on domestically, and I think because international people pay so much more already, they're just going to get the PDF.
Okay.
Because they pay like $88, and it takes 8 weeks sometimes for them to get an issue. And So
this will be really this will be a really nice change.
It's going to be a big impact for the international. Well, we've lost a lot of international subscribers. I got a lot of people who are like, I can't afford it. It takes so long to get here. It has to go through our post office and then the Italian post office or the German post office. It's a messy thing.
Just a messy
many complaints from people who are like, I've waited for 9 weeks and I haven't seen my magazine yet. Or they get them, they'll get one and then they'll get the one from two months earlier. And we have, once we send it out the door, we don't have any control over it. So
okay.
I think that, now this would be overseas. It probably won't be Canada, Mexico. But certainly the people who are really waiting a long time, I think we'll just give it to them.
Okay, excellent. Well, that'll be good news for those folks that are overseas.
So.
And we have listeners that are there, so I hope you heard that. Now, a moment ago, you had mentioned, it's been just over a year since Locus founder Charles N. Brown passed away. What advice do you find, that he imparted that's kind of channeling through you most often?
That's tough. Boy, he's, I don't know what... I saw that question. You gave me that question earlier, and I couldn't think then. And I was hoping it would just come to me, but it's not. He was a smart guy, and I think probably the best thing was that he was really focused on the magazine and on the field. And a lot of people get caught up in the sort of politics or the internet frenzies and the flame wars.
Mm-hmm.
And, he would say, just ignore it. It's just getting in the way. And at the time I always was like, how can you, I'm a worrier. I worry about everything. And now I know when you're running this magazine or probably any company, you don't have time to worry about that stuff. You need to keep your eye on what you're doing and not let it get to you. Don't sweat the details, And he was really good at that. He was a worrier too, and I think he had to probably learn how to do that.
He really wanted
to make science fiction great and fantasy. And I'll tell you something else that wasn't really a piece of advice, but something that he used to say is that, like someone was talking the other day about some awards and everyone's always complaining about things. And I was like, if you look at the field and you strip away all the awards, like there's no Nebulas, there's no World Fantasy, and there's no Hugos, and there's no Locus, take us right out of it, then there's a bunch of authors hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is what brings us together. It's about the fiction. But these things that people like to sort of make fun of or say they're crappy, but they're the things that bring us together. They're the things that show the world that we think this stuff is important. And, that was why he made Locus. He made Locus because science fiction is important, and a way to show the world how important it is to have a whole magazine dedicated to just talking about it.
And explaining why it matters. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And if you get rid of all of these things, you lose value, and you lose that chance to show the world how important it is. So I think that's actually that's something that I carry around with me, because it's easy to get down on yourself or, wonder what's going to happen with the field and, in the middle of a recession and everything. But just remember, it's important.
And these are conversations and stories that should be shared. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. They, help form people and make dialogue and discuss things that can't be discussed in, realistic terms or try out ideas or test solutions or, foresee dire consequences. There's so many ways it can be used, and it is important. So.
Well, speaking of things that are important and sharing that message, one of the things I saw in an interview you conducted about a year ago, shortly after Charles's mm-hmm. passing, you had mentioned establishing his personal science fiction collection as a private library. What's the current status of the library?
It's done a lot of research into grants. Because we can't afford to hire a librarian.
Sure.
And we can't afford to have our staff, current staff, start cataloging all of these books. And we really need to go through, everything needs to be cataloged, we had an archival assessment, we had a preservation assessment, I've been doing all this stuff, and honestly, I think it's a few years out.
Okay.
I think it's a few years out before we have a working database that people can look at and say, oh, you have that edition of this, and we need to look at it for our research, or I'm doing a paper on this, and I need to see physical copies of these things. But it's still there. I mean, the collection's still there, and it's still building. But the act of creating a library is a lot larger than
endeavor one might
and we do actually, we have all the books cataloged in, well, we have a lot of the books cataloged. We catalog everything in print, but part of Charles's collection existed before we started doing that, and we don't have a good record of what exactly we have.
Okay.
Versus what has come out in print, because essentially all of our indexes and recording has been what is in print and genre. You know, we are the record for that, and so. But it's still, I had an intern spend 2.5 months working on trying to build a grant proposal that would allow us to get some money towards that. But it's going to be a long process.
Well, it sounds like the wheels are in motion. You guys are doing all the right things for the research.
We'll keep
checking on that.
That's right. Sure. Well, and I mean, these wouldn't be books that people would be able to check out. You know, everything is going to stay on site. But we have, almost complete runs of all the pulps, and we have books, first edition signed books from when Charles started collecting on to today. So it's a very extensive collection, and it's important. You know, a lot of libraries weren't collecting these books because they were, trashy pulps, crass commercial entertainment, and so there aren't versions of these things in libraries.
Well,
a lot of these things.
And it's unfortunate, too. I mean, I'm from the Kansas City area, and at the University of Kansas, because of James Gunn, he started a special collection there as well with the pulps, knowing that we've got to retain that history, and a lot of it was just thrown away because of the time, the way it was viewed. So,
exactly. Yeah. So it's nice to have that, and we're definitely maintaining it, and it's definitely on the list of many things that I have to do. But it's, we spent a long time trying to build these grant proposals to help, but grants are tricky, and it's a long, slow-going process, but we'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get there. And actually, the works are still, if someone was doing research, we've had people in there studying and doing research and looking at original copies, and so it's not unavailable. It's just not cataloged in
a
way that's...
Okay. That could be meaningful for a researcher.
Right. But we'll get there. We actually have a large collection of photographs in ephemera also that we're hoping to catalog and make the catalog available.
Well, when you have that ready, make sure to let us know and we can talk to you.
I'm sure it would be a big announcement.
We'll look forward to talking to you about it then. Where can people find out more about Locus?
Other than locusmag.com. Locusmag.com has more information than I think anyone knows.
You guys have a Twitter account as well, and I know you do announcements via Twitter.
We tweet all of the updates. Well, almost everything except for one small section that doesn't have an RSS feed, but I'm working on it. But all of the updates to the homepage, which include perspectives, which are like review columns and essays and commentary articles, we have news that goes online and tweets. We have the blink section that I mentioned before gets tweeted. Any features. So if you follow us on Twitter under Locus Mag, you can get updated with all that stuff. We just started another Twitter stream called Locus Chat because several staff members are like, I want to tweet. but I want to keep the Locus Mag one just... The news and the information. So we've got that, and there's www.locusmag.com, and the magazine itself, So
excellent.
That's us.
Anything else you'd like to mention to our listeners that I may have missed?
No, I think we did a good job of covering everything.
Read Locus.
Read Locus. Tell somebody who doesn't know about Locus. That would be the best thing. Because it's hard to reach past the community sometimes.
Yes, it is.
That's actually, you know, we all, it's like when you discover fandom, you're like, wait, there's this huge thing and I didn't know. But it's hard then to, you know, you have to remember those people don't know. You know, how many people at Microsoft read science fiction and how many of them know about Locus?
Locus.
I don't know.
Well, and it was interesting when I was at Viable Paradise last year and we were talking with, I had one of my one-on-ones with Patrick Nielsen Hayden. Mm-hmm. He's one of my instructors. And so we, you know, we're obviously talking business. And I said, you know, if you were to give an aspiring writer three pieces of advice, or for that matter, just a couple, it didn't have to be three, what piece of advice would you give? Mm-hmm. And his first piece of advice is, if you're not subscribed to Locus,
right.
you should be subscribed.
Right.
That was his piece of advice.
I think, so. And just quickly, I think sometimes it's daunting because people don't know what to look at in Locus. Like, you get this thing and there's all...
It's massive. It's like world fantasy encapsulated in pages.
And there are sections that are important to different people. You know, the collectors and the book buyers and the librarians really like the books lists. They like forthcoming books because they can look forward and see what books are coming out and when they're coming out. But I think the other publishers should be looking at that and seeing when books are coming out and checking their schedules and making sure that things are coming out, you know, in a way that makes sense.
Sure.
You know, reviews are great for readers, but they're also great for book buyers and they're also great for librarians. And they're also really good for writers to see what is working.
Yeah, what's being published?
Right, and we do short fiction reviews, we do long fiction reviews.
Yeah, sure.
What's working? What's hitting for the critics? What's making them happy and what are they complaining about? You know, and then people in publishing is huge, and I think a lot of people don't even know what to take away from that. But you can see what agents are buying, what kinds of books, what's selling, what countries are buying foreign rights, what titles are being used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so-and-so delivered this book of this title. You know, let's not have three books by the same title come out next year.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of information in there, and I think sometimes it is daunting, and you know, it almost needs to come with a primer or something. Like, this is how to, you know, get through the information just for the person who really is unfamiliar. You know?
Well, and it took me some time, but I think over time you figure out how to use it,
right.
You know, and through, it's almost been a combination of the con and the magazine. You kind of figure out how to use it. Well, Liza, with your schedule, this has been great. And with all you've got going on this weekend, I truly appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
It was great. It was my pleasure, absolutely.
Thank you.
We'll do it again sometime.
Definitely.
Okay.
And we are back. Thank you again, Liza, for coming on the show. And of course, for your recent sponsorship of the podcast. We really appreciate that. And go to locusmag.com to check out more details. We'll have more details in our show notes, of course, as things have changed a little bit in the time of since the interview. So all the current details will be in the show notes. Okay, let's go ahead and jump into some feedback. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, one thing for you, though, Brent. When you were doing that interview with her and she mentioned mermaids, were you going like, really? Mermaid
really?
Fiction? what would that be called? Murfic?
Murfic.
Why not, man? It seemed totally plausible. I don't know why everybody else would be disbelievers on the whole mermaid fiction. Moses, come on, man.
Daryl, we need another Daryl Hannah mermaid movie. So yeah, I'm all for it.
You're all for it?
Yeah, sure.
She may be a little long in the tooth, though. But
yeah, well, I don't know.
You know, get a new Daryl Hannah.
I think
Daryl Hannah.
Yeah,
I was gonna make a comment about her fin sagging at this point, but maybe we shouldn't go there.
Yeah,
I'll cut that out.
yeah, Liza in particular was even a little dubious of the Murfic. She was. I don't know if you could pick that up in the interview, but
I did pick that up.
Yeah.
And not to mention, if we call it Murfic, there would be people who think we're talking about Merlafferty.
Very true.
She might want to coin that. Yeah. Okay, so some feedback from last episode. There's a great blog feedback we got, so everyone can go to the blog and check it out for the show notes of episode 109. And the feedback came in from Lou Anders, editorial director of Pyre, who's been on the show a number of times. And we were talking a lot of, in that show about piracy. And he relates some of his own personal experiences to piracy, where an anthology he was working on and one of Pyre's own fantasy novels were actually pirated long before they were scheduled to be released. And the piracy really hurt the sales of those particular works. And he kind of wanted to make sure we weren't being too light on the idea of piracy. And it's a good thing for us to mention, because we don't want to have any miscommunications about that, that none of us are suggesting that anyone should go out there and pirate someone else's work. So definitely it's a good thing to get out there. And the comment is definitely something everyone should come check out for the show notes of episode 109. But guys, I know you had some thoughts on this too. So what were your thoughts to the comment that Lou left for us?
Well, I think Lou's feedback it certainly extended the conversation we had. You know, we certainly talked about Chris McKittrick's situation, and obviously when he had his book pirated, that put him in a really bad position. But having Lou share his experiences, and even just from a content standpoint, if you're a fan of content, put yourself in the position of the reader, and you enjoy a piece of work, that's a potential side effect. I think that was really eye-opening to me in reading Lou's comments, is that you might enjoy a work, but if it's been pirated and then it becomes not financially viable, you run the risk of having a publisher not be able to continue on with any additional works in that milieu, and that's unfortunate. So that was, I know his feedback in that regard was really eye-opening to me.
Along that line, I got into 4th edition D&D a couple years back, and they stopped producing the PDFs of their books that they were producing, you know, because they were just being pirated all really badly. You know, and then it was kind of a bummer, because it used to be nice to have it on the PDF and you could just do a quick search and find what you're looking for. So that's an example of where piracy, you know, hurt the people who wanted the electronic version of that thing. And then who knows what it may have done to someone who liked that edition. Maybe, you know, Wizards of the Coast put less money into expanding certain things because of money lost from it. So, yeah, piracy is a very emotional issue I've found for writers to talk about. It's pretty strong feelings. There's something Lou said I wanted to also agree with. He had, again, in Locus, the new issue has this section on digital publishing. And so he had a little thing about ebooks that was nice. And he makes the point, this is something that I think is an important point. If you think that pirating an ebook is not a big deal because there's no cost to an ebook, you know, that really is a myth a lot of people believe. He points out all the other costs that go into producing books, and the actual printing, you know, and the shipping and the storage of the books, it is a cost, but it's relatively small actually compared to the whole cost of producing a book: acquisition, editing, copy editing, types editing, proofreading, cover art, design, layout, marketing. He says 30 to 35 people have some input significantly into every book that Pyre produces. So there's so much work that goes into producing a book, even if it is an ebook. And I think that's a really good point. He also points out that, you know, for him, ebooks actually have more value than a print book. I agree completely with that. I like the convenience and so many of the other features that they have. So, I certainly feel like it's worth, you know, it's worth supporting that.
That echoes the sentiments of, you know, Liza in the interview, even when she talks about the magazine and talks about essentially that whether it's ebook or the printed magazine, those are almost just shells, and the real product is the content. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where the expense goes, is in the content. And if they're having to reformat the content, that's just added expense.
And the one Absolutely. Thing about Chris's experience that we talked about in episode 109, you know, his book got pirated, and the way the timing worked out, he was able to say, okay, well, this sucks that this happened, but how can I turn this to my advantage? And he was able to use that negative situation in what seems to be a positive way. The fact that he did that got a mention on Boing Boing, and I don't think he would have gotten mentioned on Boing Boing if that hadn't happened. So part of this too is if this does happen to you, you know, what can you do to make the best of the situation?
He fortunately was, from a timing standpoint, in a position where he identified the problem early enough to where he could, you know, recruit some help and be able to find developers to put other versions out there. And so from a publicity standpoint, he was able to get some publicity around it. and draw people's attention to the issue. It sounds like in Lou's case, it happened well in advance from him even being ready to to have a product out there.
I did see a discussion about this recently on an indie author message board, and someone said that she had gone to some of these torrent sites, and one of the things that she had done was contact the people who run it and say, hey, this is my book, can you please take it down? And that worked in some cases. Another example was that she went to that torrent and somehow she was able to make a comment on it and said, hi, I'm the author, please buy the book. And apparently that did some good as well. And then there are people who say, you know, it's a thing that happens these days, and a lot of the piracy is overseas, and they're probably not your customers anyway. And it's something that, to some degree, you have to kind of accept and find a way to work with.
You can write us, of course, adventuresinscifipublishing.com. The voicemail number that you're going to hear in a second is no longer active. That's how long it's been since we got a voicemail, and I failed to keep it alive. So we'll get a new voicemail, and I'll re-record that soon. But don't bother calling. Not yet, anyway. Guys, thank you very much for recording late at night, and we'll see you again real soon.
Adios.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, book reviews, film reviews, videos, coverage of live events, and so much more. You can leave us feedback at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com or call the voicemail line at 206-350-5029. All contact information can be found on the About Us page on the website. Until next time, keep reading. By the way, one thing I want to do is start... I always think about doing this, but then I get lazy. Is putting in like bloopers at the end when one of us screws something up and we're recording. Because I had a really good one in the last one we did where I started. I'm like, what the hell am I talking about or something?